summer in Sweden, 1961. Childhood memories.
September månad det året var fortfarande mycket sommarlik.
September was still very summer-like that year, and we swam in the sea every day and enjoyed it to the full. When we left for home from the seashore, Marlena's mother stopped at a kiosk to buy us ice cream. Marlena and I stayed in the car, waiting and waiting. We watched her mother standing in front of the kiosk with an ice cream cone in each of her hands. In the end, she came back to the car with two melting cones. She told us that the plane that carried Dag on a mission in Africa had crashed.
Hammarskjöld. Dag Hammarskjöld.
Dag Hammarskjöld, wie man den spricht.
How do you say that?
Dag Hammarskjöld. Name, den ich wahrscheinlich aussprechen könnte.
And it's a name I probably couldn't pronounce.
Hammarskjöld?
Jag talar lite svenska.
I speak a little bit of Swedish.
Dag Hammars... Oh my god. Kjöld?
A cloudy day in Hamburg, Germany. A large billboard overlooks a labyrinth of metal fences funneling streams of commuters over a square. Office workers in casual clothing, speaking with absent business partners through their earpods. Travelers pulling their trolleys in haste. In a corridor winding between construction machines, they rush over the strip that remains of the wide square linking Domtor Station with the nearby subway. Many months ago, the city put up the billboard, unfolding a vision of what the Dag Hammarskjöldplatz may look like after reconstruction. Few of the passersby stopped to take notice.
Hat er was mit Gärten zu tun?
Does he have something to do with the gardens?
Okay, das war ein norwegischer Weltenbummler, oder?
Oh, right. He was a Norwegian Globetrotter, wasn't he?
Er war ein ehemaliger, entweder ein UNESCO- oder NATO-Präsident.
He was a former UNESCO or NATO president, something like that.
Der erste UN, der erste? Jedenfalls ein bedeutender UN-Generalsekretär.
That's the first UN, the first? In any case, an important UN Secretary General. When his phone rang at night on April 1st, 1953, Dag Hammarskjöld dismissed the news of his appointment to the UN as an April Fool's joke. A week later, the Swede officially became the second Secretary General at the young organization. Western powers and the Soviet Union had finally been able to agree on a candidate from whom they didn't expect any trouble. They hoped to have found just that in the diplomat known, if at all, as an intellectual. To most leaders, Hammarskjöld was simply a blank. A few weeks later, the Swede with the unpronounceable name disembarked from the plane in New York to take office. Call me Hammarskjöld, he used to tell journalists. That's actually what it means. To the great surprise of many who had appointed him, Hammarskjöld had no intention of keeping a low profile at the UN. With diplomatic talent and a clear vision of his mission, he negotiated in international post-war conflicts such as the Suez Crisis. It was under Hammarskjöld's leadership that the UN first dispatched armed emergency forces that came to be known as the Blue Helmets. Soon, democracies emerging from colonial rule hopefully turned to the UN as protector of their self-determination. One of those countries was the Republic of the Congo. None of the conflicts in which Hammarskjöld negotiated during his two terms as Secretary General of the UN proved to be a greater challenge than the Congo crisis, the aftermath of which is still felt today. After half a century of colonial rule, Belgian forces retreated from the Congo in 1960. A short time later, secessionists and mercenaries, backed by mining companies and foreign intelligence agencies, vied for power in the young democracy under President Lumumba. In early 1961, Lumumba was assassinated. The UN Blue Helmets deployed to the region found themselves in the middle of a humanitarian crisis. Time and again, Hammarskjöld returned to the Congo. At the brink of exhaustion, he sought solutions and dialogue with leaders. On September 17, 1961, the Secretary General boarded a UN plane at the airport in Leopoldville, today called Kinshasa. The aircraft traveled on an undisclosed route through the night toward the Katanga province to negotiate a ceasefire with the rebel leader Moïse Tshombe. It was the afternoon of the following day that search planes spotted its smoldering remains, which had cut a swath through the forest. On the approach to Ndola, in today's Zambia, Hammarskjöld's plane had dropped out of the sky. To this day, the cause of the crash remains unclear. When Hammarskjöld's friends later cleared out his apartment on the Upper East Side, they found a manuscript on the bedside table. It contained a personal diary that Hammarskjöld kept throughout his adult life. It is a testimony to the doubts that raged behind the diplomat's austere facade, the inner struggles of the tasks that never stopped challenging the idealist that Hammarskjöld was. The pages contained various writings, contemplations, maxims, poems, some of them with a specific date, or at least with a year. For the year 1959, there's a collection of more than 100 poems written in the Japanese haiku tradition. With the manuscript, Hammarskjöld's friends also found an undated letter. In it, he shared his thoughts about his diary with a Swedish colleague. "It was begun without a thought of anybody else reading it," he writes. "But what with my later history and all that has been said and written about me, the situation has changed. These entries provide the only true profile that can be drawn. That is why, during recent years, I've reckoned with the possibility of publication, though I've continued to write for myself, not for the public." Poeticized by W. H. Auden, Hammarskjöld's private writings appeared in English in 1964. Published under the title Markings, the book now counts among the classics of spiritual literature. A deep passion for poetry links the biographies of Dag Hammarskjöld and Sir Tim Hitchens. As a diplomat, postings in the service of the British Foreign Office took Hitchens all around the globe, to Paris and Africa, to Pakistan and Brussels, to Afghanistan, and eventually Japan. Like Dag Hammarskjöld, Tim Hitchens has been reading and writing poetry for most of his life, and ever since he began learning Japanese in his early 20s, the haiku has been among his favorite forms of expression.
And I think the power of Dag Hammarskjöld's poetry also comes from the inherent privacy of it, the fact that though he formally gave permission for it to be published after his death, it wasn't intended to be read during his lifetime. And there is something voyeuristic in a sense of entering into this private discussion with himself and with God that is not really intended for us, but we're given the privilege of allowed to be in there. And it links a little bit with his style actually as a diplomat, which was very, there was a famous phrase of his, "I never discuss discussions." He would do his discussions on some highly topical, sensitive issue, and wouldn't say anything about it in public because it was entirely private.
Tim's four-year ambassadorship in Japan began in 2012 and coincided with the rise of Twitter. Posting as UK Amb Tim, the haiku he wrote and tweeted in Japanese eventually reached more than 7,000 followers. In 2019, he published a book of the posted haikus with their English translations and watercolor illustrations. Here's a sample. "All the while worrying, I try my hand at haiku."
And so we were all encouraged to work, do some of our work on Twitter and to communicate and engage with the public in wherever we were on Twitter. And it seemed to me a very good thing, therefore, to use Twitter in Japanese to engage with a Japanese audience. And then a moment hit me when I thought, well, okay, there's the serious engagement on social media with Japanese public, talking to them about what the British are doing or what they're thinking about their politics or the climate change in Japan or nuclear issues. But then I wanted to leaven it a little bit with some less serious engagement. And of course, in those days, Twitter was limited to 140 characters. And in the English language, 140 characters is not much at all. I mean, you get going and suddenly you're up against your limit of 140. Whereas Japanese, like any of those East Asian languages which use characters, a single character contains a wealth of meaning. And each character is both a subject, like the word tree, but also it can convey lots of different meanings and hints from the design of the character. And so 140 of these Asian characters is a much richer diet than 140 letters in English. And so I realized if I used poetry, which itself is a very compressed form of expression, I could fit an awful lot in a piece of Japanese verse. And of course, haiku was the obvious way to do that because it has a format that one could work within. And so I started doing my poetry in haiku form, in Japanese. And there is a tradition in Japan of poetry, which is not simply writing a poem and putting it out there, but you write a poem and send it to somebody, and that person can then write a poem back to you that echoes or builds upon your poem. Or they can send it to somebody else who writes the poem that has a link, and then a circle of poetry is formed. So communication through poetry was an established art form. And I discovered that when I would write a poem, I discovered that there was a Japanese gentleman who would, with beautiful illustrations, draw pictures inspired by my poetry. And I discovered, curiously enough, that he was in fact a friend I'd lost touch with 30 years before. So we'd both been traveling the world together. And so I used to write these poems, and he would then quite often write a response in a picture form. And at a certain point, people said, that's really quite fun and you ought to publish. And that's the origin of the book, which I published. And we called it Twaiku as a little joke on haiku and Twitter. So it was called A Book of Twaiku. The haiku that I wrote tried to follow more the basic assumptions of haiku. So it was not 17 syllables. It was 5 full syllables, then 7, then 5. It tried almost always to have a season word, so a word that indicated what time of the year it was, and then always tried to have a twist of some side point in it, where you suddenly think, oh, that's not what I was thinking. And those are the kind of the three elements that I tried to constrain myself with. Whereas the Dag Hammarskjöld poems, they're constrained into 17 syllables, but not necessarily 575. They don't have a word relating to the season particularly, they won't always have a twist. In fact, they don't often have a twist. So the constraint of 17 is what he chose, and that produces a wonderful kind of poetry.
17 stavelser öppnade dörren för minnet och dess mening.
17 syllables opened the door to memory, to meaning. Dag Hammarskjöld's haiku on the 17 syllables opens a cycle of more than 100 he composed in 1959. The three-line poems revisit places from his youth or from travels he undertook as a young man and diplomat.
Hemmet sände mig till öde rymder. Få söker mig.
My home drove me into the wilderness. Few look for me, few hear me. But not all of Hammarskjöld's haiku are rooted in specific spaces. Some return to vaguer places of his childhood, to deep feelings of loneliness he continued to experience throughout his life. Born as the youngest son to the former Prime Minister of Sweden and raised in a Protestant surrounding with strong moral beliefs, Dag Hammarskjöld grew to be an idealist. Many poems in his Markings negotiate the doubts he faced on this path. Sleepless questions in the small hours. Have I done right? Why did I act just as I did? Over and over again, the same steps, the same words, never the answer.
He was in a very lonely place because of the challenges of what he was trying to do and the world he was operating in. So they, I think his poems, they have a great emotional depth to them. And that comes also very much from his childhood as well. I mean, clearly he had an exceptional childhood, both highly privileged, but also a childhood where his emotion was meant to be kept constrained. And I think that comes out in the poetry as well, which is deeply, deeply private.
Many leaders who met Hammarskjöld the diplomat described the sense of integrity he radiated. Those who met him in private could feel the sense of moral duty that defined him. Karin Vastel remembers meeting Dag Hammarskjöld when she was a child. At the age of 6, Karin went to live with Dag's older brother Sten, his wife Ulestina, and their daughter Marlena in the early 1950s. Karin's single mother had accepted a new job that involved a lot of traveling. Through a newspaper ad, she looked for a family to take care of her daughter. One of the families that responded was the Hammarskjölds.
Dag var inte generalsekreterare då ännu.
Dag wasn't yet secretary general when I moved in. Almost everybody knew that a Hammarskjöld had been prime minister. I don't know if they talked about it. What was he like, the prime minister's youngest son, who every once in a while would pay a visit to his older brother and his family?
Det var ju inget speciellt. Han var ju Stens bror. Och han kom på besök och så. Det,
han he was just Sten's brother who came for a visit. He blended in with the family. But he was extremely nice and thoughtful, and it means a lot to you as a child when someone cares. He did that 100%. Karin remembers one episode from that time in particular.
En gång när Dag kom på besök låg jag med.
One time when Dag came visiting, I was lying in bed with a fever. Dag had a book with him for me. It was about a small Gotland pony. I just remember how happy I was when he popped up at my bed with the book. He had a strong sense of justice, and he was very, very generous. I was so little, it was difficult to put people into a box. You don't do that as a child. It's rather a question of feeling. It's hard to describe feelings, isn't it?
Yeah, in the 1950s, diplomats, they had two very starkly different views of the world. And one was the Manichaean Cold War spy, really bad commercial behavior by big mining companies or tobacco companies. And then you had a high idealism post-war of what the world could be like. And I think that's less acute now because there aren't so many baddies able to do what they, you know, as freely behave as they used to now. I mean, there are plenty of baddies, but they have to be a little bit more constrained. There's less idealism as well. So the idealism is tempered as well as the brutality is tempered. But you know, one of the things you look at Dag Hammarskjöld, and he clearly had this ability to operate in a pretty brutal world where he was up against the Americans and the Russians and, you know, South African mercenaries all the time. But he had to be pragmatic to get the way through. But he had this deep inner idealism, and the poetry connects with the idealism in a way that it's a sort of a fount of strength for him to go into the negotiations again and again and to keep trying to make things better.
Hammarskjöld had made a habit of tapping into his fonts of strength long before his time at the UN. Colleagues from his days at the ministries in Stockholm remember how he would board a night train to Lapland on a Friday evening, equipped with little more than a sleeping bag, a camping stove, and a backpack filled with bags of raisins and oatmeal. On Monday morning, Dag would return to the office refreshed from the hiking tours in the north.
Vit is ranunkel, ensam bland stenarna. Frost där skuggan faller.
White glacier crowfoot, alone among the stones. Frost where the shadow falls. In the harsh climate of Sweden's north, the first blossoms of the glacier crowfoot herald the coming spring. Retreating to remote places above the Arctic Circle was Hammarskjöld's way of reconnecting with something larger, something that embraces all life on Earth. Up north, in isolated places like Saret National Park, he felt part of something that connects humans and non-humans alike, something that brought him deep peace and rooted him. Poetry was Hammarskjöld's way of giving a voice to this deep, sensitive understanding of the world around him. It was a side he kept mostly private throughout his life. As he writes in one of the haiku found after his death,
ensam i sin dolda växt fann han gemenskap med allt växande.
Alone in his secret growth, he found a kinship with all growing things. Since the time of the old Japanese masters, experiencing nature with all senses has been a key element to haiku. For his book, The Narrow Road to the Deep North, a poet like Basho would seek out the one willow where a fellow poet had rested ages ago, basking in the same shade until the farmers had planted the last straw of rice. Playing with the literary tradition and capturing the sensual impressions that the coming and going of seasons stir are key elements in Tim's poems, such as this one. From the hard earth emerge new buds, an infant voice.
I think it's no surprise that the haiku comes into its own in the 50s and 60s, just with people like J.D. Salinger and Jack Kerouac and all of those people who are counterculture people who are pushing back at an American industrial culture, which is really very heavy and big and confident and brutal. And they're looking for something that is fragile and reflective and transient and something that is being lost as the American dream advances. And I suspect that if you spoke to Basho himself and some of the great haiku poets in their era, they would probably have spoken with exactly the same kind of vehemence about, they wouldn't have said industrialization, but they'd have talked about commercialization and the city growing and the encroachment of man upon nature and capturing man's relationship with nature before it disappears. They would probably have described it in exactly the same strength then as we do now. And so this poetry isn't simply nostalgia for an age that was. This is a consistent human obsession, capturing beauty before it's too late and is overrun by humankind.
Hammarskjöld Platz lies between Damtor Station and Planten und Blumen, the large park in Hamburg city center. Since 1990, it has been home to Europe's largest Japanese garden. Plants and trees from Japan surround a pond with a tea house at its center. On a quiet morning, wind caresses the leaves of willow trees. Hammarskjöld's encounter with Japanese tradition was one primarily mediated through literature. Among the books his friends found on his night table was an introduction to haiku. He never visited Japan, neither privately nor as a diplomat.
My poetry comes from quite a happy place, a place where I felt very much at home in Japan and at home in the work I was doing, and at home in an environment with a family that is very warm and supportive. So I don't have any of the deep existential angst expressed through my poetry. that he has. And indeed, it's quite true that my poetry or my haiku was definitely about sharing as it was written and trying to get a dialogue.
Tim's proficiency in Japanese has been key to using poetry to this purpose. As a poet, he even adopted a Japanese pen name. Tim publishes as Eiryu, a name consisting of two characters.
Most great Japanese poets choose their names. Basho was not Basho. He chose the name Basho, and then the names evolve over time as well. So when I knew I was going to publish, I thought I would, again, slightly playfully, find a name that mattered or made a great deal of sense. And so I worked with my Japanese friends to look for a name that was appropriate. And if people don't know how Japanese and Chinese characters work, you will very often have two parts to a character. And on the left-hand side, you will have a sign or a picture that gives a sense of the kind of word you're talking about. So it will often be something that's a tree, that means we're talking about a kind of plant. And then on the right-hand side, you will have a second picture that more gives you a sense of what the sound is going to be. And so there are a number of pictures which are associated with particular sounds. And so what you've got in A and U, A has on the right-hand side, the bit that gives the sound A, and that is the character that's always used to mean England. It comes from the early days of Japan encountering England, and it was England, Igirisu, A became the sound for the UK or England. But then on the left, you have a little sun sound picture, and that is the symbol for Japan. And this particular character is therefore one I liked a great deal because the sound is A, but it's got in its picture the sun being the rising sun of Japan, land of the rising sun. And on the right, you've got England. And then the second is the character of Yu, which means, the word is Yanagi, another reading of it, and it means willow. And again, it's a tree on the left and then the thing that gives the sound on the right. And again, as an English person, willow is associated with England a lot. So, you know, this crazy game of cricket that the English love is always, the bats are always made of willow. And also willow is often the sound, the idea of a poet for various reasons is linked to willow. And there's a lovely phrase, which is, wind in the willows, which has a great English story to it because it's a famous book, Wind in the Willows. But in Japan, it means sort of picking up a hint in the air, the sort of wind in the willows as it comes through, and you're just getting an understanding of what's going on from a vague sound. And that also felt quite appropriate to me. In Japanese religious practice, in Shinto religion, the concept of God, the word for God, isn't simply some extraterrestrial form who's somewhere up in a different area. It's things that are around us all the time. And that can be things like the sun and the moon, but it's just as much a wood, a tree, a particular rock. They can all have a form of divinity. And so that sense of the landscape around you is part of divinity in whatever way one wants it to be, is still alive and well in Japan in a way that I suspect in Europe, we think that is pre-Renaissance, the idea of landscape as divinity. And with the Enlightenment, we got rid of the divinity in our landscape. So I think those are differences between the two countries. And as you travel around Japan, you have to travel through a lot of big cities to find anything you'd describe as landscape and divine. And so the Japanese now have developed this ability both to to hunt for the farther edges of Japan where landscape still exists, and also to see natural beauty in the midst of a really harsh urban landscape in a way that, you know, many of us luckily living in Europe don't have to, because even our big cities have lots of greenery about them. In Japan, you have to hunt quite hard. Once you've found it, it's prized amazingly. And that can be either, you know, a little bit of moss in somebody's back garden, or a small tree or some flower. Those things are prized precisely because of the over-industrialized landscape that is the general truth. When I first went to Japan in my mid-20s, just married, and we lived in this place, Kamakura, which was on the south coast. And my wife and I were sitting one evening on the beach, looking out over the sea, and we could see in the distance Mount Fuji. And we said to each other, isn't this just idyllic and a wonderful spot to be? But then we remembered that we had a three-lane highway just behind us. And we'd completely forgotten that if we turned our backs and looked, it was a horrible industrial site. But we had selectively chosen to concentrate upon the bit of what we could see, which was the water and Mount Fuji. And I think one does that a lot in Japan. One blanks out quite a lot of the landscape that is ugly and concentrates on the absolute beauty that one sees in a certain space in front of you. And I think that certainly became part of what I naturally did.
As a young man, Dag Hammarskjöld sought and found such unspoiled beauty in the distant corners of his country, above the Arctic Circle or the remote coasts of southern Sweden. Many of the poems he later composed echo the sense of deep belonging and inner stillness that the mere memories of such places could instill.
Denna morgon fyllde fågelsången sinne med nattens svala ro.
This morning, the singing of the birds filled his mind with the night's cool peace. In writing haiku, Hammarskjöld rekindled memories that lay far back in time, far across the Atlantic. It was a way to give voice to a rich inner world, to hold fast to insights that had provided sustenance on his path. However, time off duty was rare during his term at the UN. Around 1960, there were only a few weekends at a summer cottage in upstate New York, or brief walks behind the fences of Central Park. As the Congo crisis escalated, Hammarskjöld rarely had the chance to tap into his fonts of strength. Those around him could sense how his mood became darker and darker as he faced the human tragedy unfolding in Africa.
People often talk about what is the Japanese aesthetic, and somebody once described it to me this way, that the Japanese aesthetic, you're standing on a precipice, you trip, you fall down the precipice, you can see the down below, you're going to die in a river, but you just grab hold of the stone briefly halfway down, and there's a little flower on it. And it's the pleasure of seeing that flower before your grip slips and you fall to your death.
Do you still have faith in man? One of his closest friends asked Hammarskjöld in mid-1961. Meaning the individual on his own, not in mobs or masses or political parties. Until then, Dag had always answered positively. But this time he looked sad and pensive as he said, "No, I never thought it possible. But lately I have come to understand that there are really evil persons, evil right through, only evil." On September 17, 1961, Dag Hammarskjöld and his party left from the villa of a diplomat friend in Kinshasa. Later that day, he would board the plane that would take him to the negotiations with rebel leaders. Friends later noted that the bed in his room had not been slept in. Dag had spent the last night outside, in the garden, waiting for the birds to greet the morning with song. This feature was produced as part of a research project supported by the Freigeist Fellowship of the Volkswagen Foundation and by Hamburg University. To continue reading about Dag Hammarskjöld, please visit our storytelling platform on www.toolong-didn'tread.de. Script and production, Bernhard Schurk and Bastian Karg. Post-production, Bastian Karg. Speaker, Amanda Lee. For interviews and for their support, we thank Tim Hitchens, Karin Vastel, Karin Erlandsson, Stephen Tester, Thomas Davies, and Libby Grohovit. So, how do you pronounce his name?
På svenska uttalar man namnet Dag Hammarskjöld.